Well, as Danny was saying, today we're looking again at this biography of Jesus that was written by the Apostle John. And we're looking at this intriguing account of Jesus' first miracle. I wonder what you think about when you hear this account. I think it's easy for us to forget just how strange it is. Often we've heard these stories so much, they're so much part of our culture that they sort of take on a mystical quality. They just exist and we don't really think about them. The weirdness of it escapes us. So I thought it might be useful just as we start for me to point out a few of the strange things that are happening here beside the miracle. First up, let's consider the context. Let's think about who Jesus is. So he's this poor guy and he's living in what might be considered the ultimate backwater of the Roman Empire. And people are making claims about him, saying that he's not a poor guy living in the backwater of an empire, but he is in fact a king. It's like, strange. But if you were a first century Jew, the other thing that you might think is strange about Jesus is that he's unmarried. Perhaps living in our world, you know, being 30 and living with your mum is not such a strange thing. But for a first century Jew, this was several standard deviations from normal. Lineage and descent was everything to the first century Jew. It placed you within their society. So the context of the story is intriguing. But let me say that the story itself is also odd. Remember that this is Jesus' first big miracle. And just think about how you might write about Jesus' first big miracle. Let's give it a go. So Jesus is at this big party and he gives this amazing speech and he's having a great time and he's pressing the flesh, promoting his cause. No, that's not what he's doing. He's in a back room arguing with his mum. And this discussion with Mary, it's so odd. Jesus appears to rebuke his mother, but then he goes and does exactly what she asks. What's that about? And finally, although he does change the water to wine, he doesn't make a big thing about it. He does it in secret so that people don't find out. What on earth is happening here? What was John thinking? Clearly, he hadn't been consulting his publicity person before he put his pen to paper. So, what are we to make of this mess? Well, the good news is, although I can't tell you what John was thinking when he wrote these words, what I can tell you is that I believe that God was working through John, and that John's mess somehow, miraculously even, gives us a wonderful insight into who Jesus was and why he did what he did early in the first century Israel, but why it's also important for us here in 2024 Sydney. So what I thought we should do today is that we'll dive into this account and first we'll look at the miracles and we'll think about the significance of what those miracles are. But then next we're going to talk about Jesus' relationship to the people around him and especially with his mum. And then finally, what I'll try to do is wrap this up and see what this says about why John thinks this reveals the glory of Jesus, what it all means. Okay, so let's take a look at the miracle first. John, when he's writing about the miracle, calls it a sign. And what he's saying is that it reveals something about the nature of Jesus. It points to something, that it revealed his glory. That it's not the miracle in and of itself that it's important, but it's what it says about Jesus that is important. And at the end of his biography, John says this. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. So with the miracles that John writes about, he shows us a way of understanding Jesus, who he is and what it means in our life. Now, when we consider miracles, there are a number of ways that we can think about it. There's a number of aspects from which we can view it. We can consider the miracle from a symbolic level. Like when Jesus feeds the multitude, we are supposed to see that this is like God feeding Israel in the desert. And therefore consider what this says about Jesus. And indeed, Jesus draws on this symbolism later when he describes himself as the bread of life. But we can also look at the miracle itself, the thing that happens in the miracle, and what that might say about Jesus' nature. A good example of this would be Jesus walking on water, where we see Jesus have power over the very forces of nature, leading to the disciples and us asking, "Who is this person?" Now, although Jesus turning water into wine is replete with symbolism, I would argue that in some ways John also presents this miracle with a lot of similarities to the walking on water miracle. The disciples saw this action as particularly revealing of Jesus' nature. It demonstrates his power over creation. It's a creation-like act. In this miracle, Jesus' first miracle, John is pointing us back to what he said about Jesus at the start of the biography. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. So in what way is turning water to wine a sign of Jesus' creation power? Now, some of you will know that I have a very sciencey background, and when I read these stories, I often think, well, what exactly is happening here? Now, there's no doubt that a 21st century sciencey type person and a first century fishing type person will have a different perspective on that. But still, I think that the readers across history, it would have been evident nothing less that Jesus is changing the very nature of matter. Now, as people, we have many ways of shifting chemicals around, making new chemicals, whether we are baking bread or forging steel. It's kind of what humans do. But as I'm sure you know, water is H2O, two hydrogens, and one oxygen atom. But if you want to make wine, you're going to need carbon, and there's no carbon in water. You'll need the carbon to make compounds that, you know, they're carbohydrate-based, so CH2O. So to mess around with atoms, to make new atoms, that's not something that people do. I mean, you can do it with an atomic bomb or a nuclear fission reactor, but the stuff you make ends up being very dangerous. It's not good. So why can't we mess around with atoms? Well, our current understanding of the universe is that it's held together by four forces. Does anyone know what they are? I've got a taker. I didn't quite hear the last one. And gravity. Gravity is kind of my favourite because it bends space-time, which also bends my mind. So, so those are the four forces. For those who didn't hear, electromagnetism, gravity, and the strong and weak nuclear force. Now, the strong nuclear force is what holds atoms together, and it's very, very strong. How strong? About 100 trillion, trillion, trillion times stronger than the force of gravity. So to change atoms, you need to have power to break this force. Now, interestingly, the only place that we think in the universe that this happens is in the center of a star, a big star, just before it goes supernova. The power required is massive. And so for Jesus to make carbon without, you know, blowing up the solar system, it's kind of a big deal. And so when we say that Jesus is changing the very nature of matter, we are saying nothing less than he has the power to bend what holds the universe together. How? He has the power of a supermassive star. Where? In his word. He simply speaks a word and it is done. It shows that he has the power to create this universe. It points back to John 1 and says, yes, he is that guy. He is God's son. All things were made through him. He has created the universe, and importantly, it says he can do it again. The disciples saw this and understood. How lucky are we that we are in the 21st century and we can see more deeply the magnitude of what's happening here in many ways. But this isn't just about Jesus' power. Remember, this is cleaning water. It's not drinking water. In the first century, you wouldn't usually drink water because it can make you sick. Think Cook's River water. And remember, he's not just filtering this water or putting it in the soda stream. He's making it completely new. He's making it something good, really good. He's taking this disordered carbon and he's making it into something beautiful. Beautiful, complex aromatic compounds, sugars, alcohol, pigments. Jesus is creating beauty out of disorder. Power, creativity, beauty. Jesus can mold the ordinary of this world into something extraordinary. So this sign, the water into wine, is showing us that Jesus can and will make things much better than before, the new wine. That his new creation won't be just good, but it will be beyond our imagination of what good can be. Like you had spent a lifetime drinking Cook's River water, and then somebody gives you fine wine. So, we can see that in this miracle that Jesus is powerful, that he is God, that he has the power to create and to mold the universe at his will. It is a sign that he has the power to create something new and beautiful and good. But if that's true, I want you to think about this. Why does John start this miracle with this odd discussion between Jesus and Mary? Doesn't this odd argument diminish the miracle? Let's take a look now at this relationship and see why it's important. Let me read it to you again. On the third day, a wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, I think it's probably fair to say that theologians have struggled with what this little passage is about. It's just odd dialogue. So is Mary saying to Jesus, "Oh, we're out of wine. Can you pop down to the bottle-o and just pick some up?" And then Jesus gets all weird on her and all mystical. And why, if Jesus appears to refuse Mary, does he then go and miraculously provide for the lack of wine? It's odd. Is there a better explanation? I think that probably context helps us here. As a question, does anyone have a rough idea how old Mary was when Jesus was born? Rough guesses. How old? I didn't set her up, just so you know. Around 15. And roughly speaking, how old do we think Jesus is when this miracle takes place? Roughly 30. So let's say Mary is about 45 years old now. Now, I want you to imagine that you are a teenager. That's going to be easier for some of you than others. I want you to imagine you're a teenager and boom, an angel comes and tells you that you're about to give birth to the Messiah, the Savior of Israel. The excitement at that time, everything that happened around it. If you haven't read Mary's song in the start of Luke's Gospel, I'd encourage you to read it because it sort of helps you understand how she was feeling at the time. But what do you think this looks like after 30 years? Jesus has been knocking around the shed, making chairs and the like, hanging out with his dad in the shed. Oh, that's a nice chair, Jesus. We might be able to sell that for a cabbage. Say, aren't you supposed to be the king of Israel? And you think your parents worry about your prospects. 30 years later, your loving husband, that man who protected you and cared for you, even after you told him you were pregnant, he believed you, that it wasn't another man, but a miracle. He loved you and cared for you, but now he's gone. You're alone. Where's that great excitement of your youth? Where is it? What would it feel like? Do you think Mary ever worried about what was happening? What were God's plans? Do you ever think she thought she might need to give God a bit of a hand, get things over the line for him? What John wonderfully shows us is this messy, unusual argument. It's an argument like happens in families. There are well-worn grooves of long-standing family discussions. It's full of things unsaid and half-asked questions where the other knows the reply. John is retelling this awkward moment when you're, you know, around at your friend's place and a family argument breaks out and you're like, what's going on? It screams of close personal eyewitness account. It's messy because that is how life is. So what specifically is the argument about? Let me propose to you that for Mary and her family, the problem seems to be not if Jesus is the Messiah, but what Messiah looks like. That is, what the Messiah is to do and when. You can see this perhaps most clearly in John 7, from verse 3. Jesus' brothers said to him, "Leave Galilee and go to Judea, so that your disciples may see you, may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. And Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here." Now, if you think about what his brothers are saying to him, it's odd because, of course, the disciples see his miracles. They see them here in this miracle that we're talking about. So what they're really saying to him is not whether he does miracles, but where he does miracles and who sees them. They think that Jesus needs to be seen, and he needs to be seen at the political center of Israel and to be declared Messiah. They're saying, your actions are not leading to you being declared king, and that is what you should be doing if you are the Messiah. They see the Messiah coming in as a glorious king, but Jesus, he knows he is on a different path. So let me argue then that Mary's comment about the lack of wine is not her making a statement in ignorance. She is not simply noting that there's no wine, but she is saying, you are the Messiah, you have the power to fix this. You have the power to fix this miraculously. Your time is now, declare yourself. So she has absolute faith in the Messiah. She understands that he can do it. And you can see this in her instructions to the servants. Do whatever he tells you. But Jesus, he may be the Messiah, but he's not fitting her plans. So what of Jesus' response? Woman, why do you involve me? Has he just been moody? The tone is formal language. It's not disrespectful. However, there's no doubt that Jesus is putting distance between himself and Mary's desires for him. But I think it would be a mistake to think that that's all that's happening here. I think that the response also says something important about how Jesus loved and cared for his mother. So how can I think that? Let me explain. When Jesus says, "My time has not yet come," what is he saying? We find the answer in John 12, the first time that he says, not his hour has not come, but that his hour has come. So John 12, verse 23, and Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." Mary, she thinks she's calling for Jesus to come as this glorious Messiah. What she does not see, and probably Jesus cannot tell her, is that she is in fact calling for his death. She is calling for his death because the path to Israel's restoration, the path that she so desires, will be through the brutal murder of her son. As the prophet Simeon said, told her, "A sword will pierce your soul." She hopes for glory for her son. Jesus knows that when his time comes, it will lead to the cross. We have a tragic but beautiful bookend to Jesus' comments here in John 2, because Jesus talks to Mary in a similar way at the end of John's gospel. In John 19, Jesus is being tortured to death on the cross. And we read this in verse 26. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her to his home. Now, remember, Mary had other children who could care for her, believing children no less. So this is not simply Jesus passing on care. It seems that as Jesus dies, knowing that his death will pierce her, knowing that she will need to learn how she saw the world was not as it was, and that her hopes for her son's worldly glory were being ripped from her, that she would need a friend to walk with her as she learns what it means to what it means that Jesus is the Messiah. And Jesus chose his best friend to care for her. "Woman, why do you involve me? My hour has not come." Can you feel the pain bleeding out of it? For Jesus, our salvation will cost him everything. And even those he loves most cannot see it. "Mum, you don't understand. For you, for me, this path is going to be rough." John says that this miracle revealed Jesus' glory. I hope you can see that in Jesus we have someone who can bend the universe at his will. He is the Word, he is the one by whom all things were created. Jesus has the power to mold this universe and to create things of beauty beyond our wildest imagining. But we also see Jesus' glory in another way, I think a surprising way. We see a man who deeply cares for his mum, who finds a way to help her even though he disagrees with her. We've seen that Jesus was a real person in a very real family. He lived amongst us. He was our friend, our brother, our son, and he loved us. More than that, he knew what it would cost him to save us. He saw the pain of separation. Even when those around him had no idea and would ultimately reject him, he knew the cost to fix this broken world. Jesus, the creator of the universe, though he lacked nothing, though he holds all being in his hands, he held none of it for us. He laid it down and took up a terrible death. He shows his glory in his willingness to suffer for our sakes. As I reflect on this, it occurred to me that I can be a bit like Mary. I believe in Jesus, that he is the Messiah, the Son of God, that he died for my sakes, for my sins. But I often struggle with God, that he's not looking at my agenda. Here's my to-do list, Jesus. We're up to point 3. Please pay attention. Like Mary, we too easily forget that it is God who acts to save us and not the other way around. And he does this because he loves us deeply, loves us even when we have our own agenda, when we are in the way. He loved us even when we were his enemy. So what should we do? I think simply this: we need to rest in his love. We need to take comfort in his love for us. We need to trust in his plan. Let God set the agenda in your life. Jesus laid down his life for you, and he has risen again, and he has the power to make all things new. He is in control. Trust in him. Amen.
We're going to respond to God's word in song, so let's stand and sing together. Never Alone.
Light tomorrow.
Friends, grab a seat. The God of the universe loves us, loves our soul. He will hold us fast. We are never alone. What great news that is. And as you're walking down by the Cooks River, just think about that getting converted into a bottle of Grange, an endless bottle of Grange. Such is the glory and wonder of Jesus. So friends, with this great encouragement and hope, let's continue our time together. Mark, are you able to be on tools for coffee? If you want a coffee, go there. Sun's going to be on the grass. There is tomato soup and a heap of bread. Fill a bowl with soup and dunk the bread in it. There's also chicken. It's like a red curry chicken. Open a bread roll, put the chicken in it, eat and enjoy. Let's continue our time together.